How long, O Lord? I cry for help, but you do not listen. I cry out to you, violence, but you do not intervene. Why do you let me see ruin? Why must I look at misery? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and clamorous discord. Then the Lord answered me and said, write down the vision clearly upon the tablets, so that one can read it readily. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and will not disappoint. If it delays, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not be late. So I'd like to start tonight's talk with a brief history of my cinematic life to date, as a way to give you a bit of context for the thoughts that follow, or maybe just to serve as a cautionary tale in other circumstances too. So the first movie I ever watched was Old Yeller. You know, the one where the kid's forced to shoot his dog because he saves their family from a rabid wolf. So my descent into darkness got off to a really great start. The second movie I ever saw was Disney's Treasure Island, which I still remember mostly as the film where the little kid gets pinned to the mast by a knife through his shoulder while shooting a sailor. And the single most memorable viewing experience of my youth, or non-viewing experience because I was hiding behind the couch, was Star Trek's The Devil in the Dark. So there was certainly darkness in those early days. Mostly, though, there was Disney. My uncle had a huge VHS collection he'd culled from years of scanning the Disney Channel. I grew up on such classics as Blackbeard's Ghost, Now You See Him, Now You Don't, Swiss Family Robinson, In Search of the Castaways, Zorro, and all the classic cartoons, features, and shorts alike. All humorous, entertaining, and pretty much harmless in both tone and theme. Now fast forward to 1999, the year I graduated from Thomas Aquinas College. But that's not actually what's important. What's important is that 1999 was the year Unbreakable came out. And I'll be honest, this whole thing is M. Night Shyamalan's fault. Because Unbreakable was a turning point for me. Everything before was simply harmless, mostly, entertainment. But everything after was much more complicated. For the first time, I realized that a filmmaker must marshal a varied and impressive array of tools: cinematography, dialogue, acting, art direction, music and sound, special effects, and more, for the sake of telling a single, seemingly uncomplicated story, or at least to tell it well. But I also, again for the first time, recognized that a film can be about one thing on the surface, a fairly straightforward superhero origin story, and about something else entirely underneath, the saving of a frayed and fragile marriage. That it can be about ideas and archetypes and themes, about how we see and experience and struggle with reality, rather than just plain old lighthearted fun. And so I embarked upon something I like to call my period of cinematic self-education, in which I became that most dangerous of men, a sincere amateur. This consisted mostly in going out to my local boutique video store and watching everything and everything, anything, I could get my hands on. From Ziga Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera to John Woo's Hardboiled, Bergman's Seventh Seal to Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express, from the early films of Martin Scorsese to the late films of Andrei Tarkovsky to everything Elia Kazan and Woody Allen ever made, up to that point, because Woody Allen continues, and everything in between, I became a cinematic omnivore, which led to the early onset of my first midlife crisis, studying film at LA City College. At night, 4 days a week, driving down at 5 p.m. into the heart of LA's rush hour traffic, and heading 2 hours back home again after classes got out at 10:30 p.m. Yes, my wife is very patient and basically a saint. Increasingly, I found myself drawn to films with dark and difficult themes. So much so, in fact, that my friends started to ask me, how can you watch such dark movies? At first, my answer was always, because my life's not dark. And there's some real truth to that, I think. Eventually, though, I started to realize that they weren't actually asking me how, but why. Why was I drawn to this sort of thing? What was the point of immersing myself in this sort of world intentionally? Why watch dark and difficult films at all? Now that question, the question of why, was a lot harder to answer, at least to start with. Because whenever it came up, all I could think to do was explain why I thought this or that film wasn't actually dark. I was stuck in particulars rather than universals. Yet as a good little TAC grad, I yearned for reasons behind my behavior, principles above and beyond the particulars. And then Flannery O'Connor happened. Not Flannery the fiction writer, because I'd been consuming her particular brand of gothic fiction for years. No, this was Flannery the thinker, the philosopher, Flannery the hillbilly Thomist. In particular, it was her understanding of the intertwined roles of violence and grace in her own stories that served as a real breakthrough for me. In A Reasonable Use of the Unreasonable, in which she explains and defends the thinking behind her most famous work, A Good Man is Hard to Find, she says this: "Our age not only does not have a very sharp eye for the almost imperceptible intrusions of grace, it no longer has much feeling for the nature of the violence which proceed and follow them. The devil's greatest wile, Baudelaire has said, is to convince us that he does not exist. I suppose the reasons for the use of so much violence in modern fiction will differ with each writer who uses it. But in my own stories, I have found that violence is strangely capable of returning my characters to reality and preparing them to accept their moment of grace. Their heads are so hard that almost nothing else will do the work. This idea that reality is something to which we must be returned at considered cost is one which is seldom understood by the casual reader, but it is one which is implicit in the Christian view of the world." End quote. "We no longer have an eye for the nature of the violence that surrounds almost imperceptible moments of grace," she says. "But why must reality be a thing we experience properly only after considerable cost? Why should we want this sharp eye at all? Because we're Christians. And as Christians, we believe the single most important moment in all of human history, the passion and death of our Lord Jesus Christ, is an instance of extraordinary violence. A moment of violence unequaled at any moment in any time that came before or followed after it. And yet, paradoxically, it is a moment that is faithfully, even joyfully reenacted every day of the year on altars and in churches throughout the world, because it is also an instance of perfect and transformative suffering. It is the most brutal of moments, but also the moment of greatest grace." Now, when O'Connor speaks of violence in the context of her fiction, she's being literal. Twisted Misfit shoots and kills little old lady kind of literal. Very literal. But I believe that her point works in a much larger context as well, a context in which it's not as obvious, but just as important. Her insights on violence and grace apply perfectly to the violence inherent in all human suffering and the way that suffering prepares us for the imperceptible intrusions and interventions of Christ in our daily lives. The intrusions that mean that our own suffering is never worthless, ever. Now, modern society has many failings, and I would hardly care or dare to catalog them here. But for me, the single most devastating, most profound failure of modernity is that it has lost the ability to recognize the transformative, salvific power of suffering. Without this ability, humanity finds itself increasingly paralyzed by the problem of the Grand Inquisitor. Why do children suffer? Why do bad things happen to good people who have done nothing to deserve such treatment? How can a kind and generous God be so brutal to his followers? If suffering were worthless and without value in the human realm, then of course those questions would haunt us. But suffering is not worthless, and failing to recognize that fact undermines not only our ability to embrace rather than succumb to it, but undermines our ability to respond to its often violent promptings to change ourselves or to allow ourselves to be changed for the better. Now, this failure to embrace suffering in one's life is a deeply human one, one that we can all understand and appreciate, I'm sure. But it is also a failure with vast and far-reaching consequences. It's the sort of failure that leads us to comfortably say that an old man has reached the point in his life where existence is simply too much to bear, and it would be a mercy to release him from his chains. or the point where we tell ourselves with a horrible sincerity that it is better for a young child with an extra chromosome to be set aside quietly rather than to be forced to live a life of suffering. What a terrible waste. A waste not just of the venerable and wise and of the young and innocent, but of the many opportunities to transform and be transformed that would have been presented to them and to those around them by their suffering. What a failure to recognize the importance of the sufferings, the violences that precede grace. Violences that prepare us for his arrival, and which, if we ignore them or strive to avoid them at all costs, will stymie his efforts to bring healing and redemption to our lives. In the words of another famous American Catholic, Venerable Fulton J. Sheen, sometimes the only way the good Lord can get into some hearts is to break them. Remember, though, Flannery O'Connor says not only the violences which precede grace, but also those that follow. To claim that suffering is without value or rationale is to recoil from its demands, refusing to recognize that its presence is calling us to action. In response to Frodo's plaintive, "I wish it need not have happened in my time in the mines of Moria," Gandalf replies, "So do all who live to see such times. But it is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." To him, the question is not why me, but what must I do? What am I being called to do? It is not a frantic effort to escape the evil before him, nor is it a rejection of its reality. But it is a reminder that we humans are galvanized into action by times of violence and suffering. And these times are no less important in O'Connor's eyes. Her grace descends upon its victims in a violent way, but it often requires a painful response from its recipient as well. Acceptance means transformation. And again, this understanding works just as well outside the narrow confines of O'Connor's Southern Gothic fiction as it does within them. It, too, is wonderfully applicable when it comes to human suffering, because for frail and broken humans like ourselves, transformation is painful and it is violent. Because while the violence of the suffering itself makes grace possible, the arrival of that very same grace begets a further violence, a violence internal, not external, a violence that we inflict upon ourselves and of our own free will. The first violence is the preparing of our souls for the seeds of grace. The second, the breaking down, the tilling, the reshaping that we work and he works in us as that grace begins to bear fruit. In The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, C.S. Lewis vividly captures this violence in How the Adventure Ended, a chapter that recounts how the horrible little Eustace Clarence Scrub, transformed into the dragon as the result of his greed in a previous chapter, is stripped of his scales, and metaphorically of his failings, by Aslan, the great lion. Importantly, he attempts first to remove them himself, but quickly realizes that he lacks the strength and conviction for the task, and looks to Aslan for help. Then the lion said, "But I don't know if it spoke. You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat down on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt." That line, "I thought it had gone right into my heart," gives me chills every time I read it. I can think of few better examples of O'Connor's notion of the violences that must follow from grace's subtle intrusions, both because it highlights the way in which he calls us to transform ourselves, and because it recognizes that our own violences are so often insufficient to that transformation. Eustace has already received the grace of repentance, but his efforts are not deep enough. They do not cut close enough to his heart. He recognizes that he must change, but his recognition and desire are not equal to the task. He must be stripped bare by Aslan and his claws, a violence more painful than anything he has ever experienced, but one that he will not forgo for the world. And if we, seeking transformation like Eustace, have lost the ability to recognize the means of our redemption in the midst of these violences, then yes, we do need a sharper eye. But what does this semi-theological understanding of a self-proclaimed hillbilly Thomist and the role of suffering in her particular brand of fiction have to do with movies? Let it be granted that our age is not well attuned to the violences of grace. Let that be true. What light does all of this cast on my obsession with cinematic darkness? On the question posed by my friends, why do you watch these? Why do I watch them? I watch them because I believe that the stories they tell are addressing the very same concerns expressed by O'Connor in her own writings. When I watch Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia, for example, I see the darkness and suffering and all too human brokenness that permeates each and every frame. But I also see the subtle offering of grace as the film progresses. And when the final moments of reconciliation arrive, I am far more moved by our protagonist's various redemptions than I would have been had their circumstances been less dire. Or when I watch Ingmar Bergman's Virgin Spring, I ache at the pain the father feels at the loss of his beloved daughter, fear for where his vengeful rage might take him, and recoil at its eventual violent explosion. But I also find myself inspired by that same suffering father's earnest struggle to understand the divine plan behind his daughter's death. And I am edified at his eventual acceptance in the face of such pain. Could such an effect be achieved without the darkness? Perhaps, but I doubt a lighter touch would or could bring the same power and emotional heft to the film's cathartic message. And so, I watch these films and others like them because I am convinced that they are the perfect way to counter our age's tendency to overlook the presence of grace in our lives and the lives of those around us. I watch dark and terrifying films because they are the stories that make his grace most obvious to me. They are an antidote for the lotus blossom of sentimentality and a reminder that violence and suffering are not just a part of our lives that must be tolerated. They are often the very means by which we are saved. These stories are the backdrop against which the workings of divine providence are thrown into sharpest relief, the shadows whose existence is necessary that we might recognize the light. They're the stories of the brutality of grace, and that is why I watch them. Hot. Now, it's all well and good to have metaphysical or even semi-theological reasons for engaging with certain kinds of films rather than dismissing them, but these principles are how I understand the particulars, not a replacement for the particulars, which means that it's time to stop talking about film in general and time to talk about some actual films. In these sorts of conversations, I like to start with the work of Christopher Nolan for a couple of reasons. His films are dark and complex. They have a definite, coherent message, and they feature fairly obvious attempts to present human nature under trying circumstances as a means to emphasize or underline certain characteristics, often, but not always, redemptive ones. And they're popular, especially his Dark Knight trilogy, which means many, even most folks, are already familiar with their stories, painted in broad strokes, at least. The three Batman films are particularly helpful in this context, because they're often cited as the stereotypes for a certain strain of dour, dark, and depressing superhero films. And I don't think they're even remotely depressing. Heck, they're not even superhero films. Not really. So let's take a look at those. And the first thing I always like to say is that Christopher Nolan doesn't care about Batman. Not even a little. Christopher Nolan cares about Bruce Wayne. And in that context, the entire trilogy can be seen as a study, or a meditation almost, on the various ways a man can confront evil. At the seemingly triumphant conclusion of Batman Begins, our caped crusader is enjoying the fruits of his newly won fame as the terrifying and effective master of the city of Gotham. But for Bruce Wayne, it is far from a triumphant moment, because he has taken his own terrors and childhood traumas and made them a citywide epidemic. He's ruling through fear, confronting the violent, virulent evil before him with his own evil, different in kind, perhaps, but not in principle. Because Bruce Wayne's fighting darkness with darkness. In The Dark Knight, he is faced with an entirely different and a far more dangerous evil. A bizarre, unmotivated, overwhelming evil that is fast-moving, relentless, and profoundly unpredictable. An evil that cannot be cowed through threats or fear. An evil which is uncompromising, and a stark example of what happens when you try to frighten evil men into obedience. In the prophetic words of Commissioner Gordon, Batman is being forced to deal with the problem of escalation. We start carrying SETI automatics, they buy automatics. We start wearing Kevlar, they buy armor-piercing rounds. And how can we forget the Joker's terrifying taste for the theatrical? Here, Wayne learns a painful truth about evil. It's not frightened. He is facing a man who's not afraid of anything. And a man without fear is a man without rules. Our hero can no longer battle evil with fear because he's facing an enemy who will always be willing and even eager to go farther than he can. But his first attempt at a new solution is nearly as problematic as before. Now, he tries to subdue evil through trickery, through deceit. He knows that his city needs a hero, but doesn't know how to give them that hero. And so he lies, fighting evil with evil still, and is nearly destroyed in the aftermath. In The Dark Knight Rises, though, he finally comes to the realization that evil can only be confronted and overcome by something in an entirely different order. Evil can, in fact, be defeated only by the good. And so, in a wonderful reversal of Batman Begins, we watch as Bruce Wayne transforms himself into the hero his city needs. Before, he tried to terrify the citizens of Gotham into submission, tried to guide them to virtue by infusing them with the very neuroses and flaws that he himself struggled to overcome. Now, though, he was doing a far, far better thing than he had ever done. But he was doing it by changing himself rather than trying to change those under his protection, going to a far, far better rest than he had ever known. By the end of the film, and at the end of his larger three-film arc, Wayne has finally realized that the only way to truly confront and confound evil is through self-sacrifice. And so he finally gives Gotham the hero it needs, himself, only transformed and purified. And that finale simply cannot work without the long, painful journey through the dark wood of his own tortured mind and soul. The darkness that surrounds Nolan's Dark Knight makes his final shining moment a far, far better moment than it would have been without it. Now, I believe the redemption on display in Nolan's Batman trilogy is fairly obvious, even in your face at times. But often, these kinds of films feature a redemption hinted, not hammered home, a redemption more promised than fulfilled. And that notion of hinting at redemption rather than hammering on it leads me next to a pair of adaptations from the American novelist and playwright Cormac McCarthy, specifically to the Coen brothers' eerie and violent No Country for Old Men and John Hillcoat's adaptation of the apocalyptic The Road. A quick pair of summaries for those that might be less familiar with these films than the Batman films. No Country for Old Men is the story of Sheriff Ed Tom Bell, an aging, laconic lawman chasing an implacable, almost satanic hitman, Chigar, across the Texas and Mexican countryside in an effort to stop his brutal rampage before things become even more violent than they already are. And in The Road, a father and his young son journey across a barren, post-apocalyptic landscape in a desperate attempt to find some relief from the cannibals and violent criminals in their path. Both are difficult films to watch, and both are well worth watching. When No Country for Old Men was released, it was widely viewed as Oscar-winning evidence of the Coens' oft-recognized and even semi-self-confirmed nihilistic tendencies. And when The Road followed in all its bleakness a few years after, it was received by some as confirmation that McCarthy's worldview was unrelentingly cynical, even cruel. These widely circulated opinions actually gave me pause when deciding whether or not to watch either. But as a self-proclaimed optimist who relishes finding light where others see only grime, I eventually sat down with both of them. And what I saw in each case was a story that encouraged and endorsed a strong belief in the notion of human dignity and are in our innate desires for greatness. In defense of this view, I would point out a particularly striking image that McCarthy uses in both stories, that of light or fire as representative of the good. In The Road, it's most clear because his characters are most obviously archetypes. The father is known simply as the man, his son is the boy. And they're obsessed with this idea of fire as a manifestation of one's behavior and moral and ethical code. Consider this exchange after a threatening confrontation on the barren landscape of their fading world. "Listen," the man says, "we have to talk. That man back there, there's not many good guys left, that's all. We have to watch out for the bad guys. We have to just keep carrying the fire." "What fire?" the boy replies. "The fire inside you. Are we still the good guys?" "Yes, we're still the good guys. Of course we are. And we always will be, no matter what happens. Always will." This image of the fire within returns at a pivotal moment towards the end of the film. Despite his desperate attempts to keep the boys safe as they creep across the threat-filled countryside on their way to the sea, the man finally succumbs to sickness and dies on a deserted beach, leaving his son alone and championless. The boy has no idea what to do, nowhere to turn. And then he meets a man, known only as the veteran, who reveals that he and his wife and his young son and daughter have been following the two of them for some time. He says that they were unsure whether to take the boy in, but that they've decided that they want to help. For the boy, though, there's a test the veteran must pass before he will follow. "Are you carrying the fire?" he asks. The veteran, taken aback, "Am I what?" "Carrying the fire. You're kind of weirded out, aren't you, kid?" "Well, are you?" "Yeah, I'm carrying the fire." And he is. And because the boy can recognize that fire, that light and that goodness present within the man standing before him, he knows that he's found his new champion. Despite the bleak future that lies before all of them, he is part of a family once again. And there's something incredibly hopeful about that. Again, this image is present in No Country for Old Men, and again at the very end, where Sheriff Bell describes to his wife the dream in which he meets his long-dead father once more. So I don't know if there are any Texans or not. If there are, forgive me, because accents are not my thing. "It was like we was both back in older times, and I was on horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold, and there was snow on the ground, and he rode past me and kept on going. Never said nothing going by. He just rode on past. And he had his blanket wrapped around him and his head down. And when he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire in a horn, the way people used to do it. And I could see the horn from the light inside it, about the color of the moon. And in the dream, I knew he was going on ahead. And he was fixing to make a fire somewhere out there in all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he would be there." His father carrying the fire and preparing a place for him whenever he got there. In the midst of all that darkness and bitter cold, a hopeful image in the midst of a cinematic world swirling with confusion, violence, and despair. And the hopefulness of that image underscores what I consider to be the most important issue raised by the film, the real takeaway message. Its emphasis on the notion of old men. It's an emphasis that suggests to me that McCarthy is a strange kind of optimist, or in my view, a strange kind of realist. In a monologue delivered by the sheriff in the general direction of his youthful deputy, Wendell, the film makes this key point. "I was sheriff of this county when I was 25 years old. Hard to believe. My grandfather was a lawman, father too. Me and him were sheriffs at the same time, him up in Plano and me out here. I think he's pretty proud of that. I know I was. Some of the old-time sheriffs never even wore a gun. A lot of folks find that hard to believe. The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure. It's not that I'm afraid of it. I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job. but I don't want to push my chips forward and go out and meet something I don't understand. A man would have to put his soul at hazard. He'd have to say, okay, I'll be part of this world. Now, the thing I think the film is trying to emphasize here is not that evil is somehow getting worse, nor that the hitman Chigurh is an unstoppable force in Bell's eyes because he's more demonic than any villain ever. He's unstoppable because this is no longer Bell's world, no longer his country. Sure, evil is ever-changing, and it has a new and horrifying face, but it's shifting, not strengthening. The devil is always on the hunt for our weaknesses, and each age does battle with him on new and uncertain turf. But that's always been true, as has the fact that God gives each generation the means to confront its demons. Where sin abounded, grace did more abound. Again, I think of Gandalf's, all we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. It's not so much that we are incapable of coping with the evil of our age, it's that we're poorly equipped to deal with the evil of the next. That falls to our children's generation, a generation personified in the film by Bell's inexperienced yet unflappable deputy. I think this is an incredibly important point, because while thinking that we live in the worst of times can lead to despair, it can just as quickly and far more frequently lead us to the second of Flannery O'Connor's two cardinal sins, that of sentimentality. To the sense that prior times were better times, and that we must try to return ourselves to those times at all costs. An instinct that leaves our current era to wage battle without the warriors proper to the current evil. In other words, it makes us all old men. Humans ill-equipped for and disinterested in confronting the evil of our own times. It is possible to be rendered blind, not have a very sharp eye, in Flannery's words, because we're so overwhelmed by the violence around us. But I believe it is far easier and more common for us to lose sight of the grace peeking through our own moments of darkness because we're constantly looking over our shoulders, convinced that things are better behind us and that the real solution is to live in the past rather than to reshape our present and pray for our children's futures. Now, I realize the films I've discussed so far are mostly more recent examples, and in general, I think it's fair to say that emphasizing the darkness is a more common vice of modern cinema, or if I have it my way, more common virtue. But that's more of a numbers game than anything else, really, because focusing on the darkness and the way it underscores or even enhances the light is hardly new when it comes to film. Carl Theodor Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc, for example. It was made almost 100 years ago, a standout from the heart of the silent era. Yet to this day, it remains one of the most brutal, violent, and inspirational films I've ever seen. Or think about that classic of Italian neorealism, Bicycle Thieves, which drags its protagonist and his young son through the worst of post-war Italy and leaves them barely better off in the end. Or consider the genre of film noir, as thoroughly American as it is difficult to define. Many argue that there is too much variation among noir films to truly capture a single essence. But it is a genre built as much on the notions of temptation, punishment, and the self-understanding that can follow upon our all too human failures as it is on the representation of the sins themselves. In other words, it's perfectly O'Connor-esque, a genre keenly aware of the intrusions and violences she discusses. One that often shows its protagonists and its audiences the power of redemption through repeated rejections of the graces offered. Think of Walter Neff, hunched painfully over his tape recorder as he confesses his crimes, and more importantly, his weakness for another man's wife in Double Indemnity. Or the third man's Holly Martins, crushed to learn that his longtime friend Harry Lime, as magnetic and charismatic a man as he has ever known, is motivated by nothing but greed and power, and is absolutely heartless and without shame. Or Mike Vargas in Touch of Evil, struggling to understand how Captain Hank Quinlan turned bad, and why people still find ways to love and respect him all the same. Or Sunset Boulevard's Norma Desmond, a woman who descends gladly into madness, rather than confront the reality of her own mortality. For our purposes, though, I'd like to take a moment to focus on a classic film that I find a fascinating example, both of these moments of grace in the midst of violence, such as we've been discussing here, and of the dangers of sentimentality that O'Connor warns against. Alfred Hitchcock's I Confess, a story of Father Michael Logan, who hears a murderer's confession only to be accused of that same crime by the very man he has just absolved. Bound by the seal of confession, he remains silent in the face of his accuser, a silence seen by the crime's investigators as tantamount to an admission of guilt. Now let's boil this film down to its bones for a moment. Let's not focus on the particulars of its plot or its impressive technical merits. It is Hitchcock, after all. Instead, let's think of it in terms of its larger themes, its overall message, painted with the broadest of strokes. Fundamentally, this is the story of a man whose principles and morals, his very faith, are being pitted against his desire for bodily safety and his instinct for self-preservation. It's hardly a new struggle, but it's so wonderfully distilled here. Father Logan is being faced by a great temptation. Speak out and free yourself from earthly dangers and derision, maybe even death, or remain silent and ensure your suffering and revilement at the hands of many. In a wonderful reminder of Gethsemane, he embraces his cross, refusing to break the seal of confession and choosing his faith rather than his safety, knowing full well that the decision could mean his very life. For what profits the man who gains the whole world, yet loses his very soul in the process? But now think for a moment about the film's ending, because the end of that film is entirely for the sake of the warm fuzzies. The film's impetus comes from Father's struggles about whether or not to talk, its arc, on whether or not he will violate his sacred office in order to preserve his own life. Will he embrace this Calvary that confronts him or not? It has nothing to do with whether or not he is freed or with his public vindication. We just want that. We, the audience. But the real moment of grace accepted is much, much earlier. You could cut the final 10 minutes from that film and it would still be a great work. A great story about accepting one's salvific moment in the midst of darkness, violence, and suffering. In fact, I think cutting the last few scenes might actually make it a better film. A film that is more powerful, more inspirational because of its darkness than one that pulls its punch just a little at the very end. In other words, I think that I Confess would be a better, more effective film if it were John Michael McDonough's Calvary. A story that is strikingly similar. We get one whose ending is different in one brutal and essential way. Again, a quick summary, which, forgive me, includes spoilers. But I think the film is possibly more effective with foreknowledge. Father James Lavelle, our protagonist, hears a man's confession, only to learn that the man intends to murder him. Father James, at the end of a week's time, in retaliation for the sexual abuse this young man suffered at the hands of another priest. There is no point in killing a bad priest, the potential killer says, but killing a good one? That'd be a shock now. For the rest of the week, Father James must struggle with the question of what to do with this knowledge, all the while ministering to the small and broken flock he's been given. Like Father Logan, Father James is threatened with death if he continues to practice his priestly duties. Like Father Logan, Father James must journey from his own private Gethsemane up the hill of his Calvary. And like Father Logan, he is confronted with a moment of choice between very obvious and very real earthly goods and those far less tangible goods promised by his faith. But unlike Father Logan, he is not rewarded for his fidelity, at least not in this life, because Father James dies, murdered by the very man he's trying to save. And what's more, his death is essential. It's a violence, yes, but it's also the only possible ending to the way he's lived in these last few days. He's a minister of souls, and he tries to the end, to the bitter, painful, violent end, to think of the needs of his flock, to find his lost sheep, rather than worry about his own safety. The actual moment when he is shot is eerily similar to A Good Man Is Hard to Find, both in its violence and in its consequences. Because it's not only a violence that precedes grace, but one from which grace flows. Only it's not his moment of grace, it's his daughter's. The daughter, Fiona, who he called in the last few moments of his life to impart an all-important word of advice, an essential encouragement. I think there's too much talk about sins, to be honest, and not enough talk about virtues, he says. And when pressed by her to name the virtue he believes most important, he responds, "I think forgiveness has been highly underrated." In other words, a man who knows that he may well be going to his death, entreating his daughter to live a life of virtue and forgiveness. A life that can only be put into action if and when she has something to forgive. He has to die. If he does not, we might earn ourselves a sentimental ride off into the sunset. But the real lesson of the film would go unlearned. The violence is absolutely necessary. Now, I'd love to go on, and I could, believe me. But I'm aware that not everyone might be quite as keen on hearing me talk as I am. So I'm going to mortify myself and free all of you by closing with a quote from Nick Pizzolatto's True Detective, a work that contains almost as much to be warned against as it does to recommend it. Yet one of the best examples of recognizing the light because of the darkness in recent memory, of embracing the nature of the violences which proceed and follow from the almost imperceptible moments of grace. It is a series built almost entirely around the character of Rust, a troubled detective battling a sorrowful and violent past and grappling daily with his great existential doubts, questioning whether there is even such a thing as reality, let alone whether or not there's any good in it. After coming within moments of death, as the result of his confrontation with the mass murderer he runs quite literally to ground, Rust experiences just such a moment of grace following upon violence as Flannery O'Connor sought to capture in her stories. Standing outside the hospital with his friend, Rust realizes that he's been wrong about life, about the nature of reality, and about the inevitable outcome of the constant battle between good and evil going on around and in our souls every hour of every day. "I tell you, Marty," Rust says, "I've been up in that room, looking out those windows every night here, just thinking. It's just one story, the oldest." "What's that?" his friend asks. "Light versus dark." "Well, I know we ain't in Alaska, but it appears to me that the dark has a lot more territory." "Yeah," from Rust, "you're right about that." Moments later, though, he takes it back. "You're looking at it wrong, the sky thing. Once there was only dark. You ask me, the light's winning." So why do I watch such dark and difficult films? Because if you ask me, the light's winning. Thank you.